Okay, folks. Well, welcome back to this second installment of our session. My apologies once again for not being able to finish up on Tuesday night, but I just was not in a state where I could do that anymore. Feeling much better now, so thank you guys for your patience and for your understanding as we made our way through that stomach bug and its effects. Thankfully, the two other members of our family who hadn't gotten it seem to have dodged the bullet, so everybody's feeling fine here now. So what we're going to do is just pick up where we left off. We've got about an hour or so of materials left, I think, and we'll see how far we can make it here. So if you have your study notes that I sent you, those might be of help. And I won't have all the pictures that I sometimes use when we're screen sharing on Zoom, but I sent those files to you as well earlier in the week. So if you want to follow along, if you want to find the paintings of some of these characters, as I mentioned them, from those Heroes of the Faith file, you're welcome to take a look at those as we go, but you don't have to. I will have a map here that I don't know if we'll be able to see it that well, but I'll just indicate it as we go along. I'm going to be talking a lot about the expansion of Christianity in Europe during this time, Christian missions on the European continent. And so I have a little map here. Whether you can see it or not, hopefully you can, but I'll just be indicating some basic geography. So if that's of help to you, hopefully it will make some sense of some of this. But again, it's not a necessary element. If you have a rough idea of where things are in Europe, you'll be just fine. We left off at Martin of Tours in our Tuesday night session. Just on the third point there under early Christian missions. So Martin of Tours is on the earlier end of what we're looking at for this section. He was a contemporary of many of the great early church fathers during that generation that produced Ambrose and later Augustine and John Chrysostom and Basil the Great and so many of those that we talked about in earlier sessions. Well, Martin of Tours was in that same time period, but he served in a much different context. So as I mentioned last time, just before we had to end, he was initially a Roman soldier, but had an experience of meeting with Christ in a circumstance in which he had given part of his cloak to a beggar by the side of the road, then had a vision of Christ cloaked in that cloak that he had given. And calling Martin to come and be his servant. So Martin resigned from the army, but he still had kind of this militaristic attitude about how he went about things. Became a priest, became a bishop, and he was consecrated to the area of Tours in what's now France. But at that time it was Gaul, so it's a Roman province. And one of the things you have to understand about the Roman Empire through most of its history was that it was predominantly an urban empire. We think of it as sort of surrounded by borders and encompassing this whole territory, and in a way that it did, but in most of these areas, you really did not have much Roman cultural presence in the rural areas, the hinterlands, right? So if we imagine Maine as part of the Roman Empire, essentially what you would have is some good Roman roads that would connect Portland and Augusta and Lewiston and Bangor, and then pretty much nothing else in terms of infrastructure and cultural presence throughout the whole rest of the state. What was there? Well, it was a whole bunch of kind of the ancestral native peoples of these areas. Back in Martin's time, those were the Celts, right? We think of Celts and Celtic culture mostly from Ireland and that area now, but in a lot of ancient Europe, they spread through much of the continent and were only gradually pushed out by Germanic people groups and other waves of settlers. At this time, a lot of rural Celts lived around in the hinterlands, around big Roman cities. And they weren't really Romanized. They weren't civilized in that sense of the word. They had their own local cultures. They practiced their own local pagan religion, as they always had. Whereas Roman folks used to think of people beyond the boundaries of the empire as barbarians and look down on them. They also look down on the people who were kind of living in their own backyards. They called them rustics and didn't really give much of a second thought to them. But Martin did. In contrast to many of the other bishops at the time who were kind of content to stay in the Romanized cities and do their ministry there, Martin wanted to get out and spread the gospel in these rural areas. That was kind of unusual for his time. More people probably should have thought about it and done it, but for whatever reason, it wasn't a big part of the Christian conception until we get to this period of history. And Martin of Tours gives this great example. So as a bishop, he didn't stay in the city. What he did was he would go out and he would interact with these local Celtic-speaking groups in the rural areas. And like I say, he still had kind of a militaristic mindset from his time in the army. And so he's here in kind of what's now France. This is a map that shows you the territories about 200 years on from Martin's time. So the coloration is not quite accurate for what we're talking about at this particular moment. But you can imagine France sort of being right here, and that's where he's operating. And what he would do is he would go into Celtic villages and basically assault their pagan religion. He'd go in, and there's a famous story of them worshiping an oak tree, or the oak tree is sacred as a representation of their faith. And he goes and he chops it down. Well, you might say, well, that's a really aggressive and kind of cruel way to practice missions. But you got to get back into the mindset of this time, right? They really believed that gods were these powerful spiritual beings. And so what Martin is doing there, yes, it's a little bit offensive off the top, but what he's doing is kind of what's called a power encounter. He's going in and he's saying, look, you think your pagan gods are powerful? I'm going to chop down their sacred oak tree, and you will be able to see whether they strike me dead or not. And if they don't, that means my God is more powerful. And so he would go down and he would do these sorts of things, chop down their trees, tear down their temples. And, sometimes people would get upset, but a lot of times the response was, wow, he's right. His God must be much more powerful. And so he successfully converted a great many of the rural, rustic population in France to the Christian faith. Next, we get a name that I think all of us know, St. Patrick, right? We got St. Patrick's Day coming up this month. It's much more than just about wearing green and having parades where people get too drunk. It's supposed to be the feast day in honor of this great missionary saint. Patrick was actually born in the British Isles, so he's part of an older Roman Christendom that lived in Britain before kind of the Germanic invasions of England pushed their population back. They were here on my map where it says Britons in kind of the Wales area. That's where Patrick grew up. And so he's a Christian. He's a Briton, but a Romanized Briton. And when he was very young, he was captured in sort of a pirate slave raid from Ireland. Folks came over, raided his territory, brought him back. And so he spent 6 or 7 years as a slave in Ireland as a kid and teenager. And then he was able to escape. He escaped. He made his way back. We don't know for sure a lot of the details of his story. There's a lot of legends out there. And historical details are just tough to track with certainty. So if you hear stories about St. Patrick, they're nice, they're possibly true, but you should know that most of the stories we have come from several hundred years after the events of his life. So we don't know exactly for sure, but we do know he was a real historical character. He had been taken into slavery in Ireland. After his release as a young man, and he had this vision where he hears the voice of the Irish calling out to him, come back, holy boy, come and bear the words of God back to us. Kind of like Paul's vision of the Macedonian in the book of Acts, saying, come over here. Patrick had this kind of experience, and so he obeyed. He followed the words of God and went back into the land of his slavery. And I talk about the courage that that would take. So he's kind of a solo missionary, taking the gospel to Ireland, a place that was pagan, and really had no impact from Christian culture at all up to that point. But he takes it back, and his ministry method is really to interact with the chiefs and the kings, because he knows from his familiarity with Irish language and Irish culture, he knows that if he can convert these leaders, these royal houses, that massive groups of people are going to at least be willing to go along with their leaders and consider the call of Christianity. And he also does a little bit of what Martin does, power encounters, disproving the powers of the pagan gods, and really has a remarkable influence on introducing the gospel to Ireland, such that Christianity becomes this keystone piece of Irish culture for the next 1,500 years. Just really an impressive, impressive story of how Christianity radically changed a culture. And we're going to be coming back to that, because it is Irish Celtic Christianity that becomes the most powerful missionary force in Western Europe during this whole period. We'll look at that in a few minutes. Another part of our story is going to happen down here in France. So now we are 150 to 200 years on after Martin of Tours, 5th and 6th centuries. And so what's happened is that Germanic-speaking people groups have pressed into the old Roman territories from this direction. They've got Slavic groups coming up behind them, so they keep moving. Visigoths are a Germanic group that settles in Spain. Ostrogoths are a Germanic group that settles in this area of Italy. And those will kind of end up blending into the local populations. If you're wondering why these areas don't speak German anymore, well, it's because that the influence of the Latin language was still so pronounced in all of these areas that even though a lot of the ethnic ruling class was now Germanic, they didn't have enough of a influence to really imprint their own language onto these areas. And so Spain continued speaking its own version of Latin, which became Spanish. The Franks picked up the Latin of their area, which became French. And the Ostrogoths blended into the Italian ancestry people there. And their language also kind of got swallowed up into Italian. But you do, of course, still have German up here in Germany, Switzerland, Austria, and so on. Anyway, one of the big people groups that came in at that time was called the Franks, from which the country of France is now named. And they were one of the most powerful that had come through since the Visigoths. If you remember from last lecture, though, I mentioned that many of these Germanic-speaking people groups, the Goths who had come through, they had actually converted to Arian Christianity. So they were holding a heretical version of the Christian faith. And one of the big questions of the time was how these Germanic peoples are now the ruling class in some of these areas. How are we going to reestablish, you know, the true faith, the Orthodox Christian faith, as taught by the apostles and the church fathers and verified by the church councils? We can't have these Arian rulers. Well, the opportunity came when the Franks came in, because on their entry, they weren't yet Christians of any kind. They were still holding to their old barbarian pagan religion that they had since, time immemorial. Well, as they're starting their invasion of this area, they're also marrying into some of the local classes. And the ruler of the Franks is a man named Clovis. He's the king of the Franks. He leads their armies. Clovis is actually the name from which Louis, eventually derives. So all those King Louis of French history are named after this guy, Clovis, King of the Franks. He ends up marrying a Christian princess from the region of Burgundy. Burgundy is this pale area here down by the, I think that's the Rhone River, yeah, sandwiched in between France and Italy. He marries a Christian princess from Burgundy who's not an Arian, but she is an Orthodox Catholic Christian. And so they kind of have this in, they have this foot in the door with the Franks all of a sudden. She writes to the bishop of a nearby town asking for help. Can we think about how we can spread the gospel among the Franks? And so this bishop has some interactions with Clovis, but he's wary about it because he's dependent on the strength and the loyalty of his war band. And if he suddenly flips to a new religion, many of them might throw up their hands and say, well, we're not following this guy anymore. So he's unsure about it. What he does, essentially, is he keeps fighting his battles, and eventually he's in the midst of one of these battles that appears to be going really poorly. The tides of battle are turning against him. And so in a moment of desperation, he prays to Jesus. He prays to this God that his wife has kept talking to him about. He says, okay, Jesus, if you are really the real God, give me the victory here. And, you know, I don't know if God always honors those kinds of prayers, but in this particular case, the tides of battle did turn. Clovis won, and so he kept his promise. And he told his other leaders, his war band, he said, this is what happened. I put my faith in Jesus, and he gave us the victory. And so Clovis was baptized as an Orthodox Catholic Christian. And all of his leaders were as well. And so all of a sudden, the Kingdom of the Franks becomes officially Orthodox and Catholic in its Christianity. And you have this major, powerful form of Germanic Christianity, which is now aligned with the apostolic teaching and the church fathers and the early church councils. And so that's kind of the linchpin. After that happens, little by little, Arian Christianity, that heresy that had already been condemned hundreds of years before, it peters out in all these other places. And the official version, the biblically faithful version of Christianity, I would say, is the one that triumphs in the end. So that's the conversion of the Franks. Now we're going to hop back up to Ireland for a minute, because as I say, Patrick's work in Ireland set the foundations for this major missions movement. And what had happened in Irish Christianity as it developed was that they organized themselves a little bit differently. Instead of like, local congregational churches and bishops as sort of their organizing networking principle, they used their own brand of monasticism as sort of the base of the Christian network. So there were kind of lay Christians gathered in congregations and so on all over Ireland, but there's also this massive movement of monasticism, monks, and it was a much more flexible version of monasticism than the one that had developed just down in Egypt and Syria. You know, we looked at that a little bit earlier. In this version of monasticism, the idea was that instead of just kind of secluding yourself from the world, you're essentially planting a missional center from which your monks, these people who are just devoted to the gospel in every aspect of their lives, praying in prayer and reading scripture, part of their lives is also going out and interacting with the local populations. And, leading worship services and teaching about the gospel and all these different kinds of things. So it was a very active and outreaching kind of monasticism. And every time a monastery got too big, you know, they would go and plant another one further down the line and the whole thing would happen again. So you had these hubs from which mission could proceed. One of the greatest missionary founders was a man named Columba. That's a Latin name that just means dove because he had a very peaceful nature. And Columba was one of these Irish Christians who started planting these missional monasteries. And he planted several in Ireland, but then he started to make the move towards Scotland. So he planted one, perhaps the most famous monastery in the British Isles. It's on a little island off the coast of Scotland, between Ireland and Scotland, called Iona. And perhaps many of you have heard of it. It stems from this period. Columba went there to this little island, thought, this is a great place for a monastery. And so he built a community of monks there who then would go out from that place and start evangelizing the western areas of Scotland. And Columba himself was part of that. He went and interacted with many of the tribal chieftains in that side of Scotland. There's one legend, again, you know, take these with a grain of salt, probably not all historical, but there is a very interesting legend that Columba got some of the local tribal chieftains to listen to his message because he displayed the miraculous power of Christ by taking this monstrous water beast that had been terrorizing them in the local river and casting it away into the depths of Loch Ness. So, you know, if Nessie ever was a real thing over in Scotland, it's got a little bit of a tie-in from St. Columba, who cast Nessie into the depths of the lake to get it out of the hair of the local people. And that's what turned them to Christ. So there you go. Again, take it with a grain of salt. Some of these legends, we just don't know, right? This is a genre of writing from early Christianity that we call hagiography, from the Greek word hagios, holy, and graphy, writing. Writings about the lives of saints. But many of the hagiographies are written several hundred years later. They're embellished with almost mythical qualities. Now, I happen to believe that God can and certainly does do miracles, especially in missional circumstances. But as to whether all these miracle stories are true or not, I just can't say. Many of them make a very good story, though. So Columba goes there, and then they, as the progress in Scotland continues, so Columba has gone here from Ireland to a little island on the west coast of Scotland, and they're kind of evangelizing in Scotland here, where the Scots and the Picts, another people group, live. They decide to go even further, and they plant another missional monastery on the opposite coast of Scotland, another little island on the other side. And you might have heard of this one as well, also famous. It's called Lindisfarne. So Lindisfarne is from Columba's family of monasteries. Aidan is one of the founding characters of that, Aidan of Lindisfarne. And from there, Aidan and his followers are able to go out and start evangelizing Scotland from that side, Northern England. And we'll hear more about Northern England in just a moment. But we got to catch up from the other direction because missions are happening everywhere. Really exciting time in church history. You thought the Dark Ages were dull and nothing happened and people just lived in muddy huts all the time? This was an age of great missionary enterprise in the church. So you have the Celtic mission movement going this way. You got the conversion of the Franks down here. But you also had these Germanic people groups that had sailed over and kind of invaded the eastern part of Great Britain. And they had pushed back the old Roman Britons into Wales. Many of these were still Christians. But the Germanic people groups that settled here in what's now England were not. They, like the Franks when they first started coming in, they're still holding on to their old Germanic pagan religion. And you probably remember from your old middle school, high school history classes, you got Angles, Saxons, and Jutes. These are the three people groups, according to tradition, all Germanic-speaking people groups that came over and settled England during this time. We say settled, it was really kind of a mass invasion because it pushed back the British population that had been resident there. So now England is no longer Christian. You got pagan, Germanic-speaking peoples Old English is a Germanic language at root, so they were speaking versions of Old English, or what would become Old English. Well, into this mix, you've got Celtic Christianity doing some mission work up here around the Scotland area, but you also have some missions happening from the other direction. Down here in Rome, you've got an amazing character who comes along named Gregory the Great. Gregory the Great is a pope, and perhaps one of the most significant popes in the history of the Catholic Church. In fact, I believe your textbook, Bruce Shelley, devotes a good deal of attention to Gregory of the Great and has a lot of good information about him. I'm not going to talk so much about some of the other things he was involved in, because he had a lot of really notable accomplishments in his own writing, his own teaching. He's the one who wrote the biography of Benedict of Nursia, that monastic founder in the West, whom I'm going to talk a little bit about him later here in this session. But amid all those other things, he was also active in mission. The story goes that Gregory, before he became pope, so he's a clergyman living in Rome, but he's not the pope yet. But as he's going through Rome, Christianity is moving away from old Roman social habits, but some of them are still there, right? We talked a few sessions ago about how the great church father Gregory of Nyssa had profound arguments against slavery. Those were having some effects. But you could still find slaves being sold in Roman society. And as Gregory is walking through Rome, he sees these Germanic-looking boys being put up for sale in a marketplace. And he's never seen people who look like this, because they're just much more, fair-haired and blue-eyed than anything he's ever seen living in the Mediterranean. And he asks the slave dealer at the time, like, what people are these? Where do they come from? And he says, oh, they're Angles. So they're from up here in England. And they're this new barbarian people group, not Christian. You actually weren't allowed to enslave Christians. It was against imperial law. But Gregory is so struck by the plight of these boys. He hears Angles, and immediately, in his language as well as ours, the association with angels suddenly took shape. Like, wow, it sounds like angels, they look like angels, but they don't know the Lord. And this broke Gregory's heart. So from that moment, he was determined, we have to bring the gospel to these people, to the Angles, to England up there. And so that was what he set out to do. Now, Gregory wasn't able to go as a missionary himself because he ended up getting appointed as pope. The earlier people he talked to really didn't want to. They weren't interested in missions in the same way he was. So he hadn't been able to organize a mission. But when he got elected pope, well, now you're the guy in charge. And so he appointed someone to go and be a missionary. The man he appointed was named Augustine. And no, it's not the same Augustine as the very famous one we talked about last time. That's Augustine of Hippo. This comes a couple hundred years later. This guy is known as Augustine of Canterbury. And he's known as that because he was sent as a missionary to England, and Canterbury is where he set up his base. So this Augustine of Canterbury is commissioned. He has a group of other monks with him, and they go, they're not actually wild about Gregory's idea at the beginning. They would much rather live in civilization than go to this new barbarian people in this distant island country. But they go, and the first little kingdom they meet down there is one of the kingdoms of the Saxons in the area of England that's now called Kent. And Canterbury was the capital of this area. So he goes to the king of this local group of Germanic Old English people and asks if he can introduce the gospel there. The king permits him to do so. Doesn't convert right away, but that happens shortly thereafter. And they set up a little chapel called St. Martin's Chapel. You can still find it today. And named after Martin of Tours, by the way. Ancient. So it's, you know, from 600 AD or something. And I've been there as a college student. I was privileged to go over and study in England for a little bit. We went to Canterbury, and this spot, St. Martin's Chapel, where Christian worship in this part of England first began, at least among the Old English people. I don't even know how to describe it. It's just a tiny little old building, not glamorous, but there was just this pervasive sense of holiness when I was there. It just struck me so powerfully. Nearby, you can still find the ruins of the monastery that Augustine and his monks built, still there in Canterbury. There's not much left to it, but you can see kind of the rubble of the stone walls of their monastery. So they planted a little, you know, worshiping community, monastery, chapel, there in Canterbury, preached the gospel. Sure enough, that royal family converts to Christianity. They send out evangelists to other parts. Soon the group that lives around London is converting. Eventually, you know, all these royal houses are tied together by marriage. So the king's daughter, I believe, gets married to a king of the Northumbrians, which is up here in northern England. And so they send a missionary up that way, one of Augustine's followers called Paulinus, and he begins spreading the gospel there. And at the same time, you got Aidan of Lindisfarne and his guys coming down and sort of meeting, these two waves of mission meeting there in northern England. Aidan of Lindisfarne teams up with one of the kings of Northumbria, King Oswald, and together they go around as a mission team, the king and this monastic leader, preaching the gospel, showing the charity and love of God to all these people. And within short order, I mean, it takes maybe a century or so, but in terms of how fast things happen in the ancient world, that's fast. The British Isles become Christian because of these amazing waves of missionary movements. But it doesn't stop there, because you still have some pagan Germanic-speaking peoples over here on the other side of the Franks, and they're still moving in this direction. You've got a group up here called Frisians who are very closely related to the English, speak almost exactly the same language. And so as you have this new Anglo-Saxon Christianity developing, heavily influenced by Celtic Christianity, they've still got this missionary mindset. And so many of them are wanting to go down and keep the wave going, plant churches, plant monasteries. One of the first ones is a Celtic missionary. So he's from kind of the Patrick Columba line of things. We call him Columbanus because he had the same name as Columba, and we just got to differentiate somehow. So we call him Columbanus, which is just a different version of his Latin name. Columbanus and his guys, they go back down here into Gaul, where the Franks are living, where there are some other pagan Germanic tribes, and they start planting monasteries along the way. They really do a lot of discipleship work for the Frankish Christians, work that honestly wasn't being done by the resident Christian bishops in that area. And they have tremendous influence, and they bring the gospel to some new people groups up in sort of the area of the Alps, what's now Switzerland, southern Germany, northern Italy, spread the gospel there. And then we have some Anglo-Saxon Christians that also follow this mission movement. The biggest name is Boniface. Boniface was an Anglo-Saxon churchman, a clergyman, and he decides to go and bring the gospel to the Frisians, meets some resistance there, so he goes down further into Germany, and he's really known as the Apostle to Germany. So we've been talking about a lot of Germanic people groups, people who spoke Germanic languages. Now we're talking about kind of that region of Central Europe, which is actually Germany geographically, and the gospel is starting to penetrate there now through the work of Boniface and others. Boniface is, he's left us a little bit of heritage in our current Christian practice, in the shape of the Christmas tree. Now, there are a lot of skeptics, lay level skeptics out there, maybe you could say, who spurn the Christmas tree because they think it's, an old pagan symbol and ought not to be associated with Christianity. Speaking as a historian, that's not exactly true. Even if it were true, it wouldn't be a problem in the view of the early church. The early church loved to take over old pagan stuff and claim it for Christ. And they weren't doing it because they wanted to secretly, hold on to some of their old paganism. They did it because they wanted to express the complete domination of the power of Christ over the old powers. So they would take like the foundations of an old temple to a pagan god, and rather than just like leaving it off on its own somewhere, they build a church right on top of it. It's not that they were wanting to secretly still be pagans, is that they believed Christ had demolished the powers. And so if you ever hear that kind of Christian conspiracy theory about, oh, we got to keep away from anything that might have been associated with paganism in the past, doesn't actually have a really great historical pedigree in terms of church history. I understand the motivation, we want to avoid all association with unrighteousness. But it's a pretty new fad, and it pretty seriously misjudges most of what the medieval church was doing. The medieval church believed in the power of Christ, and they believed in it to such an extent that they wanted to express the domination of Christ over the pagan powers. And in any case, if we were to take that kind of conspiracy theory thinking about paganism to the nth degree, Christians would never be able to use anything because, frankly, what is there that hasn't been used as a sacred symbol by paganism somewhere in the world? We would never be able to, use for symbols or to as an expression of praise to God, mountains or trees or rivers or skies or lakes or stars or rocks or any of the good things that God has made. Those don't belong to the pagans, they belong to Christ. That's my little soapbox. Anyway, Christmas tree. Some people accuse the Christmas tree of that. Most of our roots of the Christmas tree actually are Christian, and they come from Saint Boniface. They do have an interesting tie-in with the pagan side of things, though. Here's the story. Boniface was going into these pagan Germanic villages, and in one case, they're worshiping a sacred oak tree, just like Martin of Tours found. What Martin did, chopped the tree down. Well, this is what Boniface tries to do too. And so he sets it up as a power encounter, chops down the sacred oak tree. They're amazed. He's not struck dead. He suffers no ill effects. And they think, well, maybe we ought to follow this Christ. And according to the legend, Boniface says, look, you guys are reverencing this sacred oak tree. It's not even a good symbol for the nature of God. If you want a good natural symbol to think about the nature of God, think about this fir tree, this evergreen tree, right? It never loses its color or its leaves or anything like that. It is eternal in that kind of analogous sense. So as a way to help them to understand the nature of God, kind of like an old legend of St. Patrick using a clover to illustrate the nature of the Trinity. The old legend says that that's what Boniface does with the evergreen tree, right? He's not telling them to worship the evergreen tree. He's saying, look, if you want a natural symbol to think about, to understand the nature of God, think about the evergreen tree. Well, ever since that time, evergreen trees, particularly during Christmas time, became a part of the Germanic Christian tradition. And we inherit Christmas trees from that Germanic tradition. They became popular in English society when Queen Victoria, who had German family ties, she brought them over in the 1800s to Buckingham Palace. And that got publicized, printed in magazines, and suddenly it's the hot new thing. Everyone wants Christmas trees. But they actually do go back to a Christian source, as near as we can tell from history. That was a really long tangent, and hopefully, I didn't offend anyone. As I say, if you're one of those people who had that sensibility about pagan things, I understand that it comes from good motivation, and certainly you ought to let conscience be your guide. I won't twist anyone's arm to do anything they're not comfortable with. But I will say, you ought not to judge your Christian brothers and sisters for such things, because the historical narrative that often lies behind that theory is very often pretty lacking. Anyway, as Boniface, he evangelizes in Germany, actually becomes a martyr when he goes back up to Frisia, what's now the Netherlands, and tries to preach the gospel there once again, and is martyred for his faith. At this point, you're starting to get the development of real Christian civilization all through Western Europe. And it leads to one of the descendants of the Franks, a man named Charlemagne, Charles the Great. In the late years of the 8th century, the 700s, he and his people are consolidating their power in what's now France. They're able to stop the Muslim invasion, which has come up through North Africa, has conquered much of Spain by this point. They're able to stop their advance, so the Muslim tide is stemmed. And you get this this new civilization. It's called Carolingian civilization, based around Charlemagne and his court there in France. And it has a lot of tie-ins with Anglo-Saxon Christianity. Major church figures from the Anglo-Saxon movement come down and are part of this great cultural renaissance at the time of Charlemagne. He actually ends up getting declared, really kind of twisting arms to declare himself, the Holy Roman Emperor. Holy Roman Emperor. And gets the Pope in Rome to acknowledge him as such. While he's doing this, he's also kind of spreading his influence by conquering other people groups, including the Saxons up here in northern Germany. And unfortunately, Charlemagne's method of Christianization is pretty brutal. It's not missionary work. It's conquering people and forcing them to become Christians, which is not an approved missionary method, believe it or not. Frankly, actually, you can kind of see the effects that from that, there wasn't a great Germanic-Saxon missionary movement that developed, partly because the missionary methods Charlemagne had used were so brutal and so wrong. Yes, eventually this area became Christianized, but in a way that was much less efficient and had much less of the power of the Holy Spirit than did the earlier waves of mission in Celtic and English Christianity. He gets approved as Holy Roman Emperor, and as the old saying goes, this is just an old maxim from historical study, the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire. It lasted for a very long time in lots of different forms. Starts off initially here with Charlemagne. A few hundred years later, you find it kind of over here in Germany, Austria, and lasts in some forms through most of the second millennium AD. But it's not Roman. It's definitely not holy in most of its forms. You know, it's a political empire. And in many cases, it's not even an empire. It's sort of a loose federation of royal houses that are working together. It was a major event in church history, though, because it added to that schism between Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity. Remember, Eastern Christianity still got an emperor. The Byzantine Empire is still over here, this Christianized empire. And they see themselves as the Christian empire, to which Rome and its bishop should acknowledge and pay some respect. Instead, the Pope in Rome is saying, hey, I've got a hot new empire over here, and this is the one that I'm going to use to consolidate my power base. So you have this sort of political shift that's yet another thing that's pulling Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism in two separate directions. You have continuing missions, though, at the same time. From Boniface's work in Germany, you've got other folks who come on later, particularly a guy named Anskar. Anskar believes that, I think he received a vision and a dream. Anyway, he believes that it is his calling to be a missionary to the pagan, unchristian tribes in Scandinavia. Also speak Germanic-related languages. But you got the Swedish up here, you got the Norse, you got the Danes. And so he does. He's commissioned to bear the gospel up there. goes up, works in Sweden, and he becomes the beginning of that Scandinavian Christianity. We'll have more to say about Christianity and the Scandinavians in the next section when you get to the age of the Vikings and all that excitement. You also have missions going on here in Eastern Europe. We've been talking about Western Europe so much. In Eastern Europe, you have these new people groups coming down here called the Slavs, right? They're the ancestors of most of the people groups of Eastern Europe today. The Russians, Ukrainians, Serbians, Romanians, Bulgarians, etc. A lot of Slavic ethnic and linguistic influence as well. Well, there were two brothers in the Byzantine Empire, Cyril and Methodius, who were really brilliant, trained in philosophy, linguistics, statehood. They were politicians of the highest order, intellectuals of the highest order. They could have served in the imperial court and done, you know, had the best their society had to offer. Instead, they go up as missionaries to these new people groups who are kind of invading from the north. They have a heart for these folks, and their intellectual abilities, their linguistic abilities, really come into flower here. Because they, rather than forcing the Slavs to learn Greek or learn Latin, as, you know, unfortunately in Western Europe, Latin kind of became the one and only language for Christians, and it acted as an impediment to the spread of the gospel in some ways, especially later on in the medieval period. In the East, they didn't do that. They had a tradition of translating scripture and liturgical worship documents into native languages. Ulfilas had done this with the Goths previously. And so Cyril and Methodius, they go and they learn the Slavic languages, many of which had not even been written down before. They're just spoken languages. They have no written culture. And they develop an alphabet, a writing system for them, and they start translating scripture and worship documents, liturgies, into the language of the Slavs. And so if you know anything about the languages of the world today, the alphabets, you'll know that the script in which Ukrainian and Russian, for instance, are written, it's called Cyrillic. And it's called Cyrillic because Cyril invented it, this great Byzantine Christian missionary. And so they go and they're able to begin the conversion of the Slavs in Eastern Europe. I was able to go on a trip a few years back to Hungary and Ukraine and Romania, and some of that area where Cyril and Methodius had evangelized. And there was a beautiful big statue of these guys right in the middle of the town square in Mukachevo, Ukraine. And so I got to have my picture taken with Cyril and Methodius, two of my heroes. I grew up in a missionary family who worked for Wycliffe Bible Translators. And so missions, and particularly Bible translation as a form of missions, it's near and dear to my heart. After they begin introducing Christianity over here, you still have a big, powerful group that is still fairly pagan, and they're called the Rus. They're mostly Slavs, but they do have some Scandinavian influence as well, from Vikings who had, you know, forged explorations down these rivers in Eastern Europe. And they had a powerful state called Kievan Rus. So this is around Kiev. This is the beginnings of the city of Kiev, which is so much in the news today. And as they're there, they're coming into contact with these great civilizations all around them. And so they decide, hey, maybe we should explore one of these religions to see if we, like these other great civilizations, should be following one of these religious traditions. And so the ruler of Kievan Rus, who is really kind of a violent, bloodthirsty character, but is now somehow a saint in the Christian tradition because of what's about to happen, he sends out emissaries. He sends them out to a Muslim principality, to a Jewish principality. He sends them out to the Roman Catholic German royal houses, and he sends one delegation down to Constantinople to look at Eastern Orthodox Christianity in the Byzantine Empire. And then these emissaries all come back and they report to him about these religions and what they saw. Well, the delegation he sent to Constantinople in the Byzantine Empire, they had gone to the Cathedral of Hagia Sophia. And remember, we talked about this on Tuesday evening. Hagia Sophia is built, it's designed to make you feel like you were stepping into heaven. And that's what they said. They told Prince Vladimir that the beauty was such that we did not know whether we were in heaven or on earth. And that was what convinced him. He said, okay, we're going to adopt Eastern Orthodox Christianity from the Byzantines. So let's get some of their folks up here, teach us how to live this way. And so Prince Vladimir converts, his royal house converts, and that's the beginning of Ukrainian and Russian Christianity 1,000 years ago, just a little bit more than 1,000 years ago, at the end of the 900s AD. So you see this picture of just missions sweeping across Europe during this time, in the West and in the East, just a marvelous picture of the expansion of the gospel. So some of the final questions I want us to consider as we think about this are, you know, we talk about this period of history as the Dark Ages. Was it really the Dark Ages? In terms of the gospel, I don't think it was. I mean, you might say, okay, they're losing some of their literary, civilizational inheritance in writing and art and things like that that the Romans and the Greeks had. But truth be told, they're holding on to a lot more than that than you might suspect from what you've heard about history. In the Byzantine Empire, that stuff never went away. And the Byzantines were around for, you know, until the 15th century, nearly until Columbus was headed to the New World. They still had all that art and culture and literature as a living tradition. And many of their and Eastern Christian scholars helped to import and encourage the flowering of that kind of civilizational culture in the Islamic caliphates. Here in Western Europe, you didn't have quite as much of that focus on art and literature, although you did have some bright spots in the Carolingian Renaissance, for instance, around Charlemagne's court. But you also had a lot of other things going on. You had mission happening all over the place, conversions to Christianity. You had the growth of a new and powerful and stable form of monasticism in the West. We've talked a little bit about the monasticism in the East, Egypt and Syria, a little bit about Celtic monasticism, but neither of these are actually the main form that most of us think about and that most of us might encounter in our Christian experience here in the West. The main form we think about is what's called Benedictine monasticism. And your textbook a couple sessions ago would have given you some background about Benedict and the monasticism that he developed. So just briefly, we're going to talk about some of those things. But first, one I forgot to mention is that you do still have a lot of the kind of political and philosophical thought of Roman heritage and theology and culture coming down through Italian civilization. It didn't really go away. You have great figures like Gregory the Great. You have a wonderful Christian philosopher named Boethius, who during this period kind of synthesized the whole tradition of Christian theology and great philosophy that they'd inherited from the ancient world, fused it into this really beautiful synthesis in a book called The Consolation of Philosophy. And that became the predominant way that tradition was handed on. So in Western Europe, it's true. For most of the Dark Ages, you didn't have people still reading Plato and Aristotle and Cicero and, you know, all those great literary leading lights of Greco-Roman civilization. But you had people reading and copying Boethius, The Consolation of Philosophy, this sort of distilled, condensed version of that whole tradition as it had come down. And that was passed on through all of those ages and really continued to have a centering influence on the philosophy and the worldview of Western European Christianity. So let me talk just a little bit about Benedict, because I got to spend a few minutes on him and this monasticism that he founds. So Benedict was a character who lived in Italy in the, I believe, the 500s, so 6th century Italy. So this was already after it had fallen to Germanic invasions by the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, and so on. But you still have a lot of the inheritance of Roman civilization there. So a very Christian area, because you're close to Rome and that centering influence of the papacy in Rome. But it's also a society that's in a lot of turmoil because of these major socio-political changes that are happening as the Roman Empire wanes and these other people groups are building their own kingdoms instead. In the midst of this turmoil, you have Benedict. And Benedict is a guy who is deeply influenced by the monasticism that came out of Egypt, by Antony, whom we talked about, by the writings of a really great monastic writer called John Cassian, who had studied with the Egyptian monks and then came over to the West. And Benedict is inspired by these guys, and so as a young man, he sells off his family possessions and goes out to live in a cave on a hillside. And there he spends his time praying, fighting temptations, all these kinds of... There's lots of legends of him fighting temptations. You know, the devil wants to trip him up, and so he sends a beautiful young woman towards Benedict's cave. And according to the story, Benedict, so determined to get away from the temptation and not to fall to lust, that he throws himself into a massive thorn bush by the side of his cave, just to, I guess, get his mind off the temptation. Anyway, a man who was seriously devoted to fighting temptation in his life. Well, he developed such a reputation for holiness that eventually some groups of people who wanted that kind of life but felt like they couldn't do it themselves, they start inviting him and saying, look, could you come and be our leader? Could you form us into kind of a monastic community? And he warns them at first. He says, yeah, I don't know if you really want me. Like, I'm gonna expect us to really live holy lives. And they say, yeah, that's what we want. So Benedict goes with them, and the first place, apparently he was seen as so strict that they ended up, he was right to warn them. They ended up trying to poison him just to get rid of him. It didn't work. But he goes on to found another monastic community of his own at a place called Monte Cassino. And and this becomes sort of his great monastic foundation. He's learned from his experience. So when he writes down his monastic rule, it's called the Holy Rule of Saint Benedict. When he writes it, it's a serious rule about how to live an ordered, structured, monastic life towards holiness. But it's also, it has this very simple wisdom of being flexible and adaptable, of giving discretion to the abbot or the prior of the monastery in order to deal with circumstances as they arise. It's very wise. And the wisdom and the flexibility of this tradition is picked up. Other groups around the Western Roman Empire see this and they say, hey, that's really what we want. So they start adopting the rule of Benedict. And you get these Benedictine monasteries popping up all over Western Europe. And they're a little bit different than Celtic monasticism. They're not as focused on outreach. They're a little bit more insular, although they do have contacts with their local community, and they encourage a lot of lay devotion in their local areas. But their influence is really this stabilizing force in Western European civilization. You have these monasteries there, and these guys who are devoted to following after this pattern of holiness, and they become these cultural centers which are able to transmit both Christianity and a lot of the other culture, hold on to what's important in the midst of this turmoil of Germanic invasions and Muslim invasions and all these other things. Benedictine monasticism sort of becomes a rock that Western civilization can cling to during some pretty difficult years. What you also have during this time, and a lot of it is due to Benedictine monasticism, is it's true that you get a downturn in, you know, some of the classic civilized arts like painting and sculpture and architecture and philosophy and all those kinds of things, the art and the literature and the music. Those things do wane after the Roman Empire. But what you have, and what's so often missed when people talk about the Dark Ages, is that you have this flourishing of what we might call the technical arts, which hadn't been a part of Greco-Roman civilization, but really set the stage for the development of European Christianity. Among these were timekeeping, because Benedictine monasteries organized themselves around a daily schedule of prayer. It was important for them to find out ways of dividing up the time of the day in patterns that could be measured and in ways that made sense. And so they're on the front edge of something we all take for granted, which is the way we are able to keep track of time during the day. They were able to kind of put a system in place and develop ways of measuring that more accurately than had been done before, which became huge as just, again, something people take for granted, but in kind of enabling the growth of technology in later centuries. You also have big advances in land use, particularly land reclamation. A lot of Western Europe was wilderness, and it wasn't just wilderness. It was particularly in a lot of France and Germany, it was kind of what you would call unusable wilderness. And I'm not just talking about forests, but I'm talking about massive areas of ancestral swampland. The Benedictines, one of the things they did was they were agriculturalists, largely. They had this rule that they followed, and their motto was work and pray, ora et labora, prayer and work. And so they were serious about work. And what they did, they'd go plant a monastery, and then they would labor in that area around it to cultivate it, which meant sort of the reclamation of vast areas of swampland into usable land that the civilization of Christian Europe could then settle, raise crops on, develop. So again, another technical art that developed during this time. Same thing happens with sort of manuscript production. A lot of the work of monks was in copying manuscripts, and so their expertise in not only designing, but finding ways to preserve and care for and create new forms of manuscripts, as well as copying lots and lots of books, mostly scripture, but a lot of other books as well, that have been kept alive in the historical tradition because there were monks who wanted to work on something and were really good at producing books. The last thing I'll mention is that you also had a new kind of economics that flourished, and we call it feudalism, which develops during this time. It's often looked down on in historical studies as like this, biased version of top-down economics where you have a ruling class and a peasantry underneath. And in its excesses, sure, you know, that could happen. But what's often missed is that this was really a Christian expression of how to do life if you weren't basing it on slavery. Slavery was going away, and it was going away because of Christianity. And so with that big piece of the Roman civilization's economics dropping away, they got to find a new way to order their society. And so this feudal version, F-E-U-D-A-L, feudal version of economics develops, where you have these sort of tight-knit local communities based around local royalty, but kind of developing into this sort of holistic system that was able to flourish for hundreds of years. And one of its notable achievements was that it did away with slavery. Granted, the peasants may not have had the best life, but they weren't slaves. And in the Christian tradition, that's important. Slavery is antithetical to the Christian tradition, and you can see that, you can trace that in its history. So that's where we're going to stop today. I'll tip my hand and say, I don't think we should be calling it the Dark Ages. God was doing some amazing things during this time of history. So that's it for this session. I know I went a little bit over an hour, so thank you for your patience. We are going to be meeting again in just about a week and a half, so it's a little bit shorter of a gap than we've had before. So please be on the lookout for my email next weekend, reminding you of our next Zoom call. So thank you guys, and God bless.